Well, good evening. Good to see each one of you. And tonight we're still going to be looking at Joseph. And we're going to be looking at Joseph as it relates to his brothers. There we go. Today we're going to be looking at when you're wronged. Now I'm sure this has never happened to anybody in their lifetime, where someone has done something to you, and you felt that you didn't deserve it, or it shouldn't have been you in that scenario, or whatever the case may be. But certainly when we look in the story of Joseph, we see an individual who's been wronged, and by family members. So specifically, I want to look at when someone wrongs you when they are close to you. So they're your friends, they're the people who sit in the pews with you. What is the Christian's response when that thing happens? And we're going to take some pointers here looking at the story of Joseph. I recall a time when I was in elementary school, and it was winter time. I guess it was a day, probably a bit colder than today. And our school was going under a renovation. It was going under renovation because we lived in Scarborough, and someone tried to burn down the music classroom, which it went up in flames. So they were replacing it. So they had a big dumpster out beside where they were doing the repairs, and right beside that was a nice hill, and it was snow covered. And inside the dumpster were some pieces of lumber, and some people got the great idea to pull the lumber out of the dumpster to make sleds out of them and slide down the hill. Now, it looked very attractive to me, and I was watching that, and I was contemplating doing it, but I hadn't, and a few people had gone down, and at that moment, the principal came out and said, "Trombley, get into my office." So I got into the office, and I got a strip torn off of me, and of course, I thought, this is not fair. I never went down the hill. I never went in the dumpster. I never grabbed a piece of wood. All those other guys that went down the dumpster, they never got called into the principal's office. So after, I don't know how long it was, it felt like an eternity. And when it was over, I walked out and I foolishly did the eye roll. So as I was walking out the building, I did the eye roll, and then the principal said, "Get back in here." And then I got another 5 or 10 minutes taken off of me for something that I hadn't done. But I honestly thought, in that scenario, that I had severely been wronged. I had to deal with something that clearly wasn't my fault. Now, I have a picture up here of a Starbucks coffee cup, and I'm sure you know the controversy that came out largely last week over their new Christmas cups that are a little less festive than they used to be. And you know, this was a scenario where I feel, as a Christian, where I was wronged. And here's the reason why. Every time you hear, you know, Christians are bad because just look back at the Crusades and look what you did with all the people there. And they pull out all these little scenarios, and here's one more label that they can put on us to say, hey, you know, the cups, seriously, they just had a few snowflakes on them before. Now they're off. Yes, prayers are out of the school. Everything's out of the school. Now they took the coffee cups away. But here's where I feel wrong. My testimony has been pulled back a few steps. So for some people, when I talk to them, I have to get rid of the notion that we're petty and that we consume ourselves over things that really, at the end of the day, we can't really hold the world accountable to our standards. There's nothing there that says Starbucks is a Christian company that should have something resembling Christmas. So in that way, I felt that my testimony was tainted just because of what happened there. When we look at the story of Joseph, we're around chapter 41. And this place that we're at, we talked about it a bit this morning, but when you look at chapter 41 and verse 56, we're at the part where the dreams have come true, that the storehouses have been opened, and basically all the people of the earth, not just the people in Egypt, but everyone that was affected by that famine, which was everybody, was coming to Joseph to get food from what was going on around them. Now, let's take a look at our text today. Let's go to Genesis 37, if you'll turn your Bible with me. And we're just going to look at this conflict that's happening amongst the brothers to see about Joseph being wronged. And I just want to point out that Joseph wasn't perfect in this scenario too. Usually there's always two sides to a story, and there's always two parties that play a part in what conflict is going on. So, reading from Genesis chapter 37 and verse 18. And here's what it says. When they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him. And they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph to Egypt. So that's part one. Now flip over to chapter 42. Now after the famine when the famine was taking place, Joseph's brothers enter the scene. So chapter 42, we're going to do the first 24 verses. "Now Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, and Jacob said to his sons, 'Why are you staring at one another?' He said, 'Behold, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us from that place so that we may live and not die.' Then ten brothers of Joseph went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, 'I am afraid that harm might befall him.' So the sons of Israel came to buy grain among those who were coming, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the ruler over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke to them harshly. And he said to them, 'Where have you come from?' And they said, 'From the land of Canaan, to buy food.' But Joseph had recognized his brothers, although they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them and said to them, 'You are spies. You have come to look at the undefended parts of our land.' Then they said to him, 'No, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies.' Yet he said to them, 'No, but you have come to look at the undefended parts of our land.' But they said, 'Your servants are 12 brothers in all, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more.' Joseph said to them, 'It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you will be tested by the life of Pharaoh. You shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you that he may get your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. But if not, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies.' So he put them all together in prison for 3 days. Now Joseph said to them on the third day, 'Do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined in your prison. But as for the rest of you, go, carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so that your words may be verified, and you will not die.' And they did so. Then they said to one another, 'Truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore this distress has come upon us.' Reuben answered them, saying, 'Did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood.' They did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. He turned away from them and wept. But when he returned to them and spoke to them, he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. Then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain." Actually, we'll stop there because we don't need the rest of that portion. So, the question we have for us today is, How do we respond to family members and Christians who have wronged us? So when we're wronged, there's two reasons why we get wronged, at least the circumstances where we do. Either it's on purpose or it's not on purpose. It's intentional or it's unintentional. So we're looking at unintentional. You do it on purpose. Someone planned it. Someone calculated it. They sat down and said, you know, this is what we're going to do to such and such a person. It's an act of the will. It's something they want to do. Sometimes it's unintentional. Sometimes it's accidental. Never planned it. It happened by chance. It was aimless. Something went on and the circumstances went a certain way. But it also could be it's random by chance or inadvertently caused. My father always used to tell me, you know, son, accidents don't just happen. They're caused. So that would mean I'm doing something perhaps that I shouldn't be doing. And even though I didn't intend to do something, at the end of the day, I wronged somebody because of what I did. So I liken this to my daughters. I have three daughters at home. And sometimes they come to me and they say, hey, she hit me on purpose. So that would be in the category if she did it intentional. And then, Nicole's smiling, she's babysat my kids. And on the other side, it could be, hey, my sister hit me. She did it on purpose. The exact same phrase, right? But from their perception, regardless of what happened, they see it as intentional. And that's what we often do. If we have something that happens against us, we turn around and whatever the circumstances are, and this happens in the church all of the time. There wouldn't be elders if this didn't happen. Where two people have a disagreement, and no matter the circumstances, they did it on purpose. I can't forgive them because they did it to me specifically. So really, the story with my two daughters, it really depends on how we react. How we react to a scenario that happens to us. We tend to take things personal. I had two girls in my construction class, and they were good friends, and they were helping each other out, and they're working on certain things, and we got to adding and subtracting fractions. For some reason, for grade 10s, I don't know why they struggle with this, but in that class, they did. So the one was trying to help the other, she wasn't understanding, so she wanted to get help from me, the teacher. And the other one said, I already helped you. I was like, well, I just want to ask the teacher to do this. Well, what's the matter with the way that I'm helping you? And then right there, boom, they had this major quarrel that happened. So they would get out to the wood shop, and they'd get a piece of wood. And it would look like a piece of wood was going to go and try to smack the other girl. And they were in another class that was with them too, and the one was trying to make a resolution with the other one and defended her in something, and the other one shouted, I don't need your help for anything. And I thought, wow, I have to go to a VP because I think they're going to come to blows one day. So they had this misunderstanding where one was genuinely trying to help the other one, and the other one wasn't seeing it from the same eyes that the other person was. The week later, the one shows up, and she's carrying the shoes or something of the other person. Oh, this is the other girl's shoes. I'm like, why do you have the other girl's shoes? Is she still alive? I hope everything's okay. And she's like, oh, no, well, we made up. We're good friends now. I thought, wow. Sometimes it's like that with teenage girls. They have a big blow, and all of a sudden they're best friends again, and everything's good. And then the next day, it's like doing camp as well, too. So again, it's this scenario where sometimes it's the way that we look at things and the way that we perceive it. And that's what happened with these two girls there. I want to take a look at a couple of those verses that we looked at already. If you still have your Bibles open to that section that we're looking at in Genesis chapter 42. We're going to call Joseph the victim here of a conflict between two people. Now, if you look at 42 verse 7, one of the things that happens is, it says here, when Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he disguised himself to them and spoke harshly to them. He hides his identity. And the reason why he does this is that their relationship is severed. He hasn't seen them since they sold him to the traders that were coming by that way. And he found it difficult, I'm sure, to say, hey, by the way, guys, I'm your brother. And this is a long time after the fact. I think this is somewhere around 20 years after the incident has occurred with them selling him into slavery. So when that relationship is severed, it's hard to get the two to come together. Now go down to verse 15. He's suspicious. It says, for this you will be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. And if we were to look at this story in a bigger picture, it seems probable that what he was doing was he was testing his brothers to see if they were really remorseful for what they had done before. And when we have that tension with somebody else, sometimes we hide our identity. We don't want to talk to them. They're coming up this aisle. I'm going to go down the other aisle so they're not near me. But we're very suspicious of everything they do from then on. Are they trying to hurt me? Are they trying to get me? Did they say that phrase against me? And they might be talking about something completely different. But that's what we look at when we're the victim. Now go back up to verse 9. Here's what we should be doing. Verse 9 says this, Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them, and he said to them, you are spies. Now, there's not a lot said here now, but it is said later. But I wonder if Joseph said in his head, I wonder if this is the part of the dream that's coming true. God has a bigger plan here, and now I'm understanding it more fully. So when we're wanting to take things personal, we have to remember God's promises. There's certain things that he's told us that we should remember day by day, that when we run into a scenario, again, like we talked about this morning, there's a bigger picture, and we need to remember and look at that bigger picture. If you go flip over to chapter 45, a few pages over, in verse 7, Joseph learns that God's in control. 45:7 says this to his brothers, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth, to keep you alive by a great deliverance. So now we hear this, we see the full fulfillment of him understanding the dream and seeing that God had a bigger plan here. And the whole reason why God allowed his brothers to sell him and all these things to happen and for him to go to jail and be wrongly accused was to get him into this position so that he could preserve a remnant on the earth of these people during this great famine. And then I love this. When I read this the first time, I nearly came to tears because I thought it was so beautiful when I thought of Jacob. So go to chapter 46. And verse 4. And this is talking about God's will is going to happen no matter what. What he wants to transpire from the story will happen. But then you also see his kindness in this. And it says this. He's reassuring Jacob. He says, I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. Here's a guy who's bereft of his son, his favorite. He had gone through so much sorrow. If you read the whole account, I encourage you to go home and read it because it's one of my favorite stories. It's fascinating. And then you see at the end of his life that God says, you know what? You're going to see your son again. Everything's going to be okay. And he's going to be the one that's going to be with you at the end of your life to close your eyes. And I thought, what a beautiful story. Even in the midst of the family feud of this dysfunctional family, you see how God brings everything together for good at the end to those who love him, which I think is great. Now let's look at the other side. Let's pretend you're the perpetrator. You're the one causing the trouble. And you're like the brothers here. So let's flip back to chapter 42 and verse 21. They feel guilty. This is what they say. Then they said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore this distress has come upon us. One of the elders in our church has a simple saying when we have a conflict in our church. He says this, sin separates. When one person's sinning, there's no option except for it's going to pull someone somewhere apart. And here we have these brothers torn from Joseph, and again they're feeling guilty because he was pleading for his life and they didn't listen to him. So they are living with the guilt. If you go to 44, chapter 44, verse 16, we see that they have deep regret. It says this, so Judah said, what can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? How can we justify ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants. Behold, we are my Lord's slaves. Both we and the one who possessed the cup have been found. And this is the other part of the story where Joseph was testing them. And again, you can sense it in his tone, you can sense it in his word, that he has a regret for what he's done in the past. And one thing that we all want to do is live without regret. To say, I wish I had done this, or I wish I had not said this. And here they have that scenario where the perpetrators, and they regret having done what they've done. There's also a great fear. Fear that it's going to come back to haunt you. In chapter 42, verse 22, says this, Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. Your sin will find you out. And that's what happened here. There's this fear that they had with all the years that have passed, the guilt that they feel, and there's the looking over your shoulder. How is this going to come back to us? Chapter 43, verse 18, similarly says, "Now the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph, and they said, 'It is because of the money that was returned in our sacks, and the first time that we were being brought in, that he may seek the occasion against us to fall upon us and take us for slaves with our donkeys.'" Again, they're suspicious that everything that's happening around them is going to come back as a result of what they did. Then I find this interesting too. Chapter 43, verse 10. And sometimes I think we kind of overlook this, but it says in verse 43:10, it says, "For if we had not delayed, surely by now we would have returned twice." This is when the brothers had returned home. They brought back the goods. And then Jacob said, "I don't want to send Benjamin because look what's happened. I've lost this person, this person." Everyone forgets about Simeon. He's still sitting in the jail. I don't know how long he was there, but he was there for quite a long time. Long enough for them to take all of their food, use it, consume it, realize that they're out of food. And it's like, oh yeah, our brother's still in jail while we're not making things right from what we did in the past, because we're running around because of the things that we did in the past. They also get distressed and angry. Chapter 45, verse 5. This is Joseph speaking. "Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." So obviously he perceived that there was anger there. They were also quarrelsome. Skip down to verse 24. It says, "So he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, 'Do not quarrel on the journey.'" I don't know what this family looked like, but you kind of get this picture, especially with these words being said, that there was still this conflict among them. But here's what I want you to understand. Whether you are the victim or the perpetrator, and when we look at the story of Joseph, remember that God is sovereignly in control. He is working the beginning from the end. And despite all the mistakes that Joseph made earlier and the mistakes of the brothers, God still preserved his people through what was going on, which I get great comfort in, knowing that despite when I mess up, I haven't wrecked God's plans per se. God's plans are established and they will work out. But he does give us a great opportunity to be a participant, to be working in his plans. But I'd rather be on the good side rather than working out of the negative, because then we get to enjoy that accomplishment that God can do through us. So looking at Luke chapter 12, when it talks about thinking about family, when family has wronged us, it says this in verses 51 to 53. "Do you suppose that I came to grant peace on the earth? I tell you no, but rather division. For from now on, five members in one household will be divided, three against two and two against three. They will be divided, father against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, mother-in-law against daughter-in-law and daughter-in-law against mother-in-law." And you get the picture of what the Lord is speaking about here. And here's what I want to give you to illustrate this. My father and I had an interesting relationship growing up. And one thing that my father liked to do was to use language that I would normally not use. He would use profanity. So if he hurt himself, he was a carpenter, and if he stubbed his toe or hit his finger, a word would come out. And I remember one time we were carrying a piece of furniture out of the house, and it hit the door handle, and he swore. And I said, "Dad, do you really need to swear when you're doing this?" "Well, it's okay. It wasn't against anybody in particular. I was just upset because the thing hit the door." I said, "Dad, what about those verses in Ephesians that talks about, you know, let no unwholesome word come out of your mouth, and a few other things?" And he got very aggravated what was going on there. So why is it that sometimes we have conflict within a family when we're believers? And here's the reason why. Obviously, my father and I were in different levels in terms of our spiritual journey. But when we're a follower of Christ, what Christ does in our life is he sets the bar a little higher. So he says, "I want you to live like this. This is the standard where I want you to be." Not everyone in your family is going to be on the same page. Not everyone in the church is going to be at the same level as you. So there will be some point where someone says or does something that is going to basically go against the grain of where your standards have been set. So the whole point of this here is that it's inevitable in your relationships that someone will wrong you from something as simple as that. Just because when we're followers of Christ, there's a different standard that we're trying to attain to. And that's within our own family. When we think about friends, look at this verse in Psalm 49:9. It says this, and feel the emotion of these verses. It says, even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. In Psalm 55:12-14, for it is not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it the one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me, then I could hide myself from him. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, and my familiar friend. I'm sure in your life at Bethel, or even your life somewhere else, there's been someone who's been close, a close friend, and it feels like they betrayed you the worst. I'll give an example of this. When I got married, my wife and I, we knew a bit of people, and we could only afford so much. We said, okay, here's the limit of the people that we're going to invite to our wedding. We set the number at 200. So we did our first conservative list. We came up with about 450 people. I said, okay, this is the hard part. Now we've got to cut people off of this list. And one of the people that I cut off the list was a person I was best friends with when I was a kid, up to around grade 9 or grade 10. But spiritually speaking, we started to go in very different paths. But if you want to wrong a friend, try not inviting them to your wedding. Because what ensued after that was I regret it, not having invited him, because he took it very, very personally. From our point of view, we weren't trying to be intentional to hurt anybody. We just couldn't afford to invite any more people. And we had to be realistic. I haven't seen you in 10 years. But from his perspective, it was very hurtful. And we've since made contact and since made amends. But again, it's another scenario. You're not trying. But sometimes people have different ideas and different expectations. And that's why you see this pain in this thing here. You know, it was my companion. It was my familiar friend. That was the person who wronged me. So, we see a lot of examples in scriptures of families that have had problems this way. We're not going to go over these, but Jacob himself with Esau. Jacob's name means supplanter. He took the birthright, basically monetary gain, and he wronged his brother in that way. Samson, Delilah, you see betrayal there. And they had this weird relationship because they weren't married, and then they had this big mind play, and eventually Delilah gets the information out of Samson, and Samson gets caught by his enemy. We have David and Absalom, and this was a result of David's sin himself. And here we have a son that's trying to get the throne, and then they have that conflict all the way through. And then we have the example of Joseph and his brothers. And the Bible talks a lot about family and when family's wronged you. But also there's the Christians who wrong you. I don't know if you remember that story in 1 Kings 13. It's kind of this neat but weird story tucked in the middle there. And it's about the lying old prophet. And there was this one prophet who was legitimately called by God to give a warning to a king who was giving offerings to a false god. And a very miraculous thing happens with the altar being torn into pieces, but he was given very specific instructions. After he delivered the message and this thing happened, he was told, when you come home, go home a different way and eat nothing. So he started on his journey to go back home, and then there was this old prophet in the land who heard the story through his sons. Like, we heard this amazing story of what God did with this king and all that went on. So he said, go and get this guy. Tell me where he is. So the old prophet comes and meets him and says, oh, I got visited by an angel. And the angel told me that you're actually supposed to come to my house and we'll have dinner together and I want to hear this great story about what had happened. And it says that while they were sitting down that this prophet did get a revelation from God, and in that revelation was this other prophet isn't even going to make it home. So on the way home, he gets on his donkey, a lion comes out, kills him, his body's lying on the road, and here's how you know it's of God. Body's on the ground, dead. The donkey is standing there beside the body, and the lion's standing there as well. The lion doesn't move, the donkey doesn't move, and the body's there. So the prophet hears about this, and the end of the story was he takes this man and buries him in his own tomb. But here we have someone who's a fellow prophet, just like a fellow believer. The two are coming together. And the reason that he lied about it was he just wanted to get the goods about the story. He thought it was an amazing story. And as a result, one of his colleagues died because he had lied to him about what had happened. Then we have Peter. Peter denied the Lord because of fear. He denied having known him. And again, some of the closest people to the Lord in his ministry. Then there was Judas. And Judas betrayed the Lord with a kiss. I want to read that story. Just a little bit of here up on the screen. Luke 22, 3 to 6, and then 47 to 48. It says this, "And Satan entered into Judas, who was called Iscariot, belonging to the number of the 12. And he went away and discussed with the chief priests and the officers how he might betray him to them. And they were glad and agreed to give him money. So he consented and began seeking a good opportunity to betray him to them apart from the crowd. And while he was still speaking, behold, a crowd came. And the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them. And he approached Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, 'Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?'" And here's where this is significant. There's a song that it's an R&B song. It's by this group called Trinity 5-7. And they do this whole story. And I put the lyrics down for you. I'm just going to read it for you. But again, I think it's powerful when we think about those who are closest to us betraying us. It says this, "It's awfully quiet at the table tonight. In fact, it seems hard for you to look at me straight in my eyes. Is there something wrong? Do you have some place to go? Or can't you tell that I already know? You've been with me, it seems, for quite some time. And though you call me Lord of Hosts, you still have so much to hide. And this is our last dinner, and still you won't say you're sorry or you regret the crime that you're about to commit. Yes, I know why you would tell me that you love me, and I know why you would stay with me for so long. You got close to my heart so you could break it, and then you made a way, close enough to my face, to betray it with a kiss. My father told me there'd be men like you, who would wine and dine and spend most of all the time trying to confuse. I'm humble and I'm meek. Doesn't mean that I'm helpless and I'm weak, or I'm weak, but a foolish man believes that he can walk right over me. Yes, I know why you would tell me that you love me. I know why you would stay for so long. You got close to my heart so you could break it. Then you made a way close enough to my face to betray me with a Judas, you messed up. You do know just who I am. Royalty. You should not mess with me. My battery just died. Yes, I know why you would love me. I know why you would stay with me for so long. You got close to my heart so you could break it. Then you made a way, close enough to my face, to betray me with a kiss. Betrayed me with a kiss. Michael Card has a song. Talks about the same story. And his line in that is, that's not what a kiss is for. A kiss is for intimacy. It's for closeness. And you see Judas in that case where he came close enough to the Lord to betray him with a kiss. So here's the question. When we get wronged by somebody, here's the two camps you can be in. Either you are being a follower of Christ, or you have a cause for basically combating social injustice against yourself, right? Because if we look at Christ and we look at the scenario, he was humble, he was meek, he was mild. And, you know, just like a lamb before her shearers is dumb, he opened not his mouth. The same idea. He pulled back. But what we tend to do in our culture is that we want to fight whatever the injustice is. You hurt me, so I need to come back, and you wronged me, so I can't forgive you for this because it hurt too deeply. And that really should never be our response, because does it get any worse than what happened there? With Judas being with Christ for so long, and to have that closeness, and then to betray him, and the Lord basically tells him, I know what you're doing. Go and do it. That's hard to do from our perspective. So really, we need to be suffering for the name of Christ, not fighting for wrongs against ourselves. There's five ways that we should respond to people who have wronged us. Number one is this. One, we need to forgive. Number two, we have to reprogram our thinking. Number three, we need to remember that we represent Christ. Number four, we have to let God deal with whatever the issue is. And five, we need to persevere to hope. So I'll explain that. If you want to write these verses down, so I don't have it on the screen, but step number one was to forgive. And Matthew 6:14-15 says this, "For if you forgive others for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive others, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions." And Luke 23:34, "But Jesus was saying, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves." If Jesus could forgive in those circumstances, there is no reason why we can't, in any circumstance that we have with family members or people that we know, or even strangers for that matter, where we can't forgive them for what they've done. And hear what Jesus said. He says, they don't know what they're doing. And sometimes, that's where we get to the next one. We have to reprogram our thinking. Micah chapter 7, verses 5 to 7 says this. This, the context of this verse is, it's a lament. It's showing that there's no righteous people left in Israel. And it says this, "Do not trust a neighbor, and do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. For son treats father contemptuously. Daughter rises up against mother. Daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household." But then it says this, "God is the source of salvation and light. But as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me." In that context, it's basically saying everyone in Israel sinned. There's no difference today. All you got to do is look out your door. You know that everyone around you is a sinner. We know that ourselves, that we are sinners inherently. Correct? So the idea is when you reprogram your thinking and you look at people through that lens, you'll respond differently. But, you know, this is a challenge for most Christians because that's really hard for us to do. But it's impossible to do without God's help. But the point is, have a realistic expectation of how others will treat you. But the point of the last verses in that section of Micah is that God won't disappoint. Others may disappoint you, those closest to you, but at the end of the day, God will not disappoint you. So, we still need to be, although we need to be on guard for that sort of thing, those verses that don't trust these people, don't do whatever. But if we look in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that famous love chapter, it talks about what love is, and part of that is forgiveness. But also it says that love hopes, that love trusts all things, which means that even when someone has wronged you a gazillion times, you still have to give them the benefit of the doubt that this next time might be the time that they've turned. But otherwise, just like the Lord commanded his disciples, you just keep forgiving, because that's what I did. Right? So that's a strong challenge for us. That's step two, reprogram your thinking, how you look at other people. Three, you represent Christ. So this context is in reference to the end times. This is Luke 21, verses 12 to 19. It says, "But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. But you will be betrayed even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. Yet not a hair of your head will perish, but your endurance you will gain your lives." So when we act appropriately, catch those words that said, you need to have a pure testimony. Because think of the Starbucks thing, right? We thought we were having a pure testimony, whoever those people were, that said, went in an uprage and said, "You can't do those cups, it's anti-Christian." Did that help our advancement of the gospel? It actually went the opposite direction. Why? We defended ourselves for something that really didn't need defending. But what we should have done is step back a little bit. And we should have understood that, you know, we don't need to say a word sometimes. We just need to live our life the way that we need to so that our testimony isn't tainted by ourselves, which is what happened in that case. Step number four. Let God deal with it. Very simple. Proverbs 19, verse 5. It says, a false witness will not go unpunished, and he who tells lies will not escape. Remember, God says, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. We don't have to have the pressure of dealing with people who have wronged us. God will deal with that, but we got to make sure that we don't make two wrongs in that scenario by reacting in an inappropriate way. And number five is this. We need to persevere to hope, and I love this because the Bible always ends off very good. All right, James chapter 1, verse 12 says this. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. God wants us to persevere when we're wronged. And here's the main reason. When we're talking about our testimony, you got to remember that the people who are around us, if they are not fellow Christians, they might be our family who's lost, or they might be someone out in the world who's lost. Their life, their soul, is hanging in the balance. So what would you rather be? Right about the cup while your brother goes to hell? Or forget about the cup, act responsibly the way the Lord wants us to, and hopefully have a window into your brother's heart. Do you see the big picture, the big perspective? And that's what we need to be shooting for. So those are the five things. Forgive, reprogram your thinking, remember that you represent Christ, let God deal with it, and persevere to hope. The last little passage I'll leave with you is this. In Isaiah chapter 1, you can read the whole passage when you get home. But this is God's response to him being wronged by his own people. He says this in a couple of those verses. He says, listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons I have reared and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger, but Israel does not know, and my people do not understand. That's what we tend to be like sometimes. In that chapter, around verse 21, it mentions that Israel has played the harlot. You have this relationship between God the Father and his people. It's like a marriage relationship. And the harlot is the one who goes and seeks other lovers. And if you read the Old Testament, that word is mentioned multiple times. Because that's how God views his relationship with us. I brought you in. I reared you. You're my people. You don't even know who I am. You're not even listening to me. Even the donkey knows who made him, and all the other animals who aren't even important. But you guys have forgotten your first love. And we need to make sure that, again, when you look at the life of Joseph, I always think, big picture, big picture. What is God's story? What's my part in that story? And in this case, you know, when someone wrongs me, is it really that bad? Usually the testimony is not against myself. We know the people around us are sinners. I know that I'm a sinner. I need to forgive. I need to oftentimes forget. Sometimes there's two options my wife always talks about when she's counseling people. You either need to confront, and there's scenarios in Scripture where you do confront. Matthew 18 is all about that. And there's other times where you absorb. So you just, okay, I understand where they're coming from. I know what the situation is. Really, I know it's not personal. I'm not going to take it. I would make a pretty lousy teacher if every time a kid acted up, I thought it was personal, right? There are so many things happening in different students' lives. And those teachers actually literally go crazy. They're the ones that go on stress leave because they think it's all against them. But, you know, kids laughing at me, even if it's against me, I don't care if they're laughing against me. It's not personal. That's not my job. My job is to be a mentor to them, to teach them and to lead them, regardless of what they're doing on the side. I maintain my testimony so that I can in turn hopefully help them. So hopefully that's been helpful to you too. The two aspects that we looked at today, this morning with work ethic and tonight, what do you do when someone wrongs you and how do we think? So again, good lessons from the life of Joseph. Hopefully you get excited and go home and read about Joseph again, reading that passage in Isaiah. But let's just close in a word of prayer together. Father, again, we thank you for your word. There's such wisdom in it, such practicality. Thank you that we can open it freely in the place that we live. We don't know how long we'll be able to do so, but help us when in these times to just absorb your truth. And Lord, help us to absorb it so that when we walk in our daily life, that we would reflect Christ in every way, the way that we think, the way that we react, and what we say and what we do. Help us to understand that if the world hated you for doing what was right, then the likelihood the same will happen with us. And help us to remember that big picture, that we can count it a joy to suffer for you. And Lord, to know that you are with us all the way, and that we can persevere to hope, knowing that you have reward for us. May you find us faithful. Lord, we just pray your blessing as we part tonight, as we return thanks to you again for your presence with us. Thank you in Jesus' name.